Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating the pod. We all appreciate every effort you make to help us grow the show. Coming up on this week's episode, how heart attacks can be triggered by infections that come from dental bacteria. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us science@newstalk.com or you can tweet us. We're at Newstalk Science. We get to all of those comments at the end of the show. We're joined in studio to go through the week's news by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen of UCD. You're both very welcome. Shane, our first story has to do with climate engineering.
Yeah, we've spoken about this on the show a few times, I think. Geoengineering. So it's the idea that basically we would use our engineering skills to somehow kind of temper the effects of climate change. So we'd interfere with the natural system to do something. And this story is about 40 polar scientists who've come together to say that most of the...
Which is unusual for the poles.
It is, yeah, absolutely, normally.
Not the nationality, but the...
Oh, right.
South-north.
Yes, absolutely. Normally quite far apart indeed. So they've come together and they have written a piece saying most of the geoengineering ideas are a little bit pie in the sky and that we really shouldn't be thinking this is our way out of climate change.
It seems like not a very bold statement for a letter of 40 people. Like, you all got together to say that?
Well, they use science in order to inform their response. So the headline is, like, you know, this isn't good enough. But the nuance, which is always the meat of the paper, is an assessment of the various geoengineering strategies that are proposed. I didn't know about them. I'm sure you did. But one of them is a seed in clouds. So we've all heard about that, right?
You know, silver nitrate.
Yeah, exactly. So it particles in the sky and it seeds clouds, which in turn would prevent warming to some degree. The other one I'd never heard of was actually thickening the sea ice. So you get pumps and you thicken the ice
underneath.
In the poles. But you would need, this is one of the criticisms, like millions of pumps for this to work.
And robotic little UAVs.
Exactly, yeah. And the other one is building a big dam to keep the glacier in, which kind of sounds good. I think what
weight glacier to stop it falling off.
Exactly, yeah. To stop it falling into the sea and to causing sea level rises and various other effects, like, you know, the amok circulation being affected by salinity levels. So they went through most of the well-known ones and they sort of said the likelihood of this actually having some impact, the degree to which it, we could actually do it in terms of an engineering point of view and various other things. And they said, you know, there's a lot of concerns. There could be environmental damage from doing the geoengineering. That's kind of unforeseen. Most weather is chaotic in its nature, so it's hard to know all of the outcomes. As I said, disrupting weather patterns. An interesting one, geopolitical tensions. What happens if you see clouds and all of a sudden places that used to have a temperate climate growing grass all year, like Ireland, can no longer do it? We might get more rain as a consequence, etc. How would we feel about it if, say, our neighbours in Europe or across the Atlantic Ocean were interfering with our weather through their intervention?
Probably better than if the Brits were responsible.
Ah, yeah, come on, let's face it. Absolutely.
Advanced nations of the world are messing with everybody's.
Yeah,
actually, that's true. Just by virtue of the fact of how we live. Yes, yeah. That's very true.
But I mean, like, you've got a pretty good court case against, you know, I mean, obviously America gets picked all the time, but like, you know, on average, five times as much consumption of carbon dioxide per person is, you know, it's a pretty good. Wait a second.
Yeah. Then there might be the case made that for not doing it, right? So for not, if we know that we could do certain things that might have an impact, say on sea level rise, for example, might micronations that are, you know, the small island nations be saying, you know, you not taking an action is having a consequence on us. But that the last point that they make here is that geoengineering offers false hope for tackling climate change. Now, they do stress there are certain things we can do that can help. And I think the most promising one is carbon capture. It's still at the early stages. It's not the silver bullet, but I saw very convincing data from Stephen Chu, the Nobel Prize winning in chemistry this year, who was formerly Obama's science advisor. And he showed how very small scale carbon capture can work. Mm. But unfortunately, it's not yet energy efficient. It costs more energy to have the carbon capture than it collects. It's like the nuclear
fusion. Sounds like fusion.
Yeah,
absolutely. It sounds like nuclear fusion.
Jonathan. Yeah. Yeah.
10 years away. Oh my God. Okay. Our second study, Ruth, that we wanted to talk about has to do with the brain and how the brain makes decisions.
It does. And this is a huge piece of work. It's not one paper in Nature this week. It's two papers in Nature this week. And it comes from the International Brain Laboratory, which isn't one laboratory, but actually a consortium of over a dozen neuroscience labs from all over the world, including MIT, Princeton, University College London. So some of the top labs in the world. And the question that they're trying to really answer is, really, where in the brain do we make a decision? And I suppose when you look back over the history of neuroscience research, we often talk about areas of the brain like they're very discrete, like we talk about executive decision making in the prefrontal cortex of the brain. But in reality, we don't know exactly how these things happen. And we've had technologies to now look at individual neurons. You know, you mentioned a guest coming in with that cap that people can wear to see what's going on. So we've got better and better at looking inside the brain to see what's going on. But the problem is labs all over the world are doing different things, and it's difficult to compare studies from different species, different techniques. So all of these labs used exactly the same protocol for the experiment that they ran. And the experiment was using mice, and they used a technology called neuropixels. And neuropixels are very, very fine electrodes that go into the brain of the mouse. But each different thing, which is like a fine hair that goes in, has many, many sensors on it. So it's measuring activity in lots of different parts of the brain. And they used over 130 mice in 12 different laboratories. But they recorded from over 620,000 neurons using nearly 700 of these probes over the course of several sets of experiments. And the mice were head constrained, and they had been trained to move a little wheel, essentially sort of a graphic in front of them to move a circle into the center of a grid. So they've been trained to do that. So that's an action that requires kind of motor skills, because they had to move the skill. There was sensing, they had to see what was going on. Mm-hmm. And they also had to cognitively make a decision. And I think the really surprising thing that came out of it was, in fact, all parts of the brain were lighting up during this process. In fact, 95% of the mouse's brain was kind of involved in some way in this decision making.
Wow.
So it's really challenging, this idea that there's any kind of simplistic pathways or areas in the brain.
Which is kind of funny, because one of the things I love about, you know, neuroscience discoveries in the, you know, the 1800s and 1900s was that, you know, someone would get a whack in the brain and all of a sudden they wouldn't be able to, you know, have a long-term memory, or they wouldn't see someone's face, or they would think somebody was a hat. All these sort of, you know, incredible discoveries about, oh, that part of the brain must be responsible for that. It gives you the sense that there are little compartments in the brain responsible for different things.
Yeah, the left brain, right brain thing. Yeah. Complete myth. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, they talk about kind of 300 discrete areas in the mouse brain, and many of them will map onto ours. Like 279 of those areas had neurons lighting up in the course of the mouse looking at this thing, making a decision to move, and then moving it. So it kind of does really challenge a lot of our thinking in how one makes a decision. And it's very interesting, because they also looked at when the mice had prior expectations about what was going to happen, how that changed the patterns in the brain. And that's really interesting, because that's some of the things that are impaired when people have cognitive decline. It's this idea that you're losing memory, you're losing that expectation piece. So it's very interesting to understand how that happens. And even better, this is the biggest neuroscience open access data set now. They have published every single scrap of the data for everyone to dive in and look at. So really amazing
Something
work.
To do for the weekend.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Our third story, Shane, has to do with sweat.
Yeah, and awkward stains. Mm-hmm. And as someone that does the dinner in my household and tends not to put the apron on until I've made a mistake, I suffer with this issue, right? So I get like splodges and splashes, and then trying to remove them is tricky, right? I remember years ago at The Young Scientist, this group of young people came along, brother and sister, and their mum ran a clothes shop, and they were sick of her using harsh chemicals to clean the clothes. And so they looked at natural ways to clean clothes and across different types of stain and different types of natural detergents and worked out what was best. It was brilliant. I hope they're listening. But this paper paper takes it to a whole new level. Instead of using kind of chemicals like bleach or hydrogen peroxide, they used light. They used blue light, an LED that's very, very strong, and it had the same effect. In fact, it had a better effect. So it was able to oxidize the stain and remove it, or rather to change it from being kind of, you know, colored to colorless, so you didn't see it on your clothes anymore. They used it for a number of different types of stains, not just sweat, but also like blood and tomato ketchup and the usual ones. And then they used it
like in the Aerial Ad.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's never, it's never blood, is it?
No, exactly. Yeah.
Blood or urine, is they just never pop up in the vomit.
No, which is the ones, let's face it, that's what happens. And they looked at different fabrics, including delicate fabrics, and they were able to show that intense blue light is able to use ambient oxygen, and it's able to turn the stains, which are typically double bonded carbon structures, into a different chemistry that's transparent and therefore looks clean to the eye.
Does that mean we could just all buy a powerful UV light and keep our clothes clean, or is this a very difficult thing to do?
But our
to turn
wardrobes
into a product?
Just have LED lights in them, and you just hang your clothes back up. And
I was thinking of that, but I the first thing I googled was, how does blue light get rid of smell? Right, because smell comes from like bacteria and other things there, so it's not going to clean your clothes on that level. Where I think this is could be revolutionary is removing the harmful chemicals we use in dry cleaning. So dry cleaning is not a very sustainable process. So this could be for those stubborn stains, Jonathan, this could be a new way of tackling cleaning.
That's very cool. Our final story, Ruth, has to do with babies and crying.
It has to do with babies and crying. And really how when we hear a baby crying and our sort of blood pressure starts to rise, there's definitely something going on from an evolutionary basis. I mean, human babies are pretty helpless when they're born. So it makes sense that they've evolved a mechanism to get attention when they need something.
Just like Jonathan.
not quite fully helpless. And this is research from the University of Saint-Étienne in France. They didn't have a huge number of people in this study. They had a small number of volunteers, about 60, I think. And over a number of sessions, they played different infant cries to them and they monitored what was going on in their body. So they played cries that were sort of from mild discomfort, where they'd recorded the sound of a baby maybe having a bath, to something where their baby was really upset, like getting a vaccination. And they also played them birdsong as a control, an adult crying, to see what happened when they did those. And what they found was that when they played them the most distressed infant cry, their facial temperature rose by 0.2 of a degree centigrade, almost instantaneously. So they used thermal imaging to look at them as they were hearing these cries. And the more rough the cry was, so they have this phenomenon called non-linear phenomenon in a cry. So that's where you hear like pitch breaks and noise bursts going up and down.
Yeah, that sort of a thing.
Sorry, everybody. Yeah, that the more rough the cry was from the baby, the more quick this response was, the temperature went
up.
It's
just a stress response, right?
I think it probably is. I mean, the people who they used in the study had apparently little or no experience with babies. I don't know if that has any impact. Maybe people who have more experience have learned to tune it out.
They'll be fine. As my doctor said once to me, when we brought in one of the kids who was particularly upset, he said, "All crying ends eventually."
Wow.
Which I thought was pretty dark.
Harsh. A bit harsh.
Yeah.
But, you know, evolution is very clever. And I suppose this is another study which shows us that.
Very good. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. Thank you very much. Now, there are many ways to image the brain, but they all have their limitations and complications. MRI machines are pretty big and not very portable. An EEG would be great at telling you when things are happening, but not exactly where. So here comes Professor Redmond O'Connell. He's trying to solve this problem. He's a professor in decision neuroscience at Trinity College Dublin. He joins me now. So tell me a little bit about this scanner, Redmond, because you're trying to deal with things like epilepsy and dementia. And sometimes in those situations, brain imaging isn't easy.
That's right, yeah. So, like, there's two basic questions that we have when we're trying to study the brain. We want to know where in which parts of the brain are active at a given time when we're performing a certain task. And we also want to know when it's active. So if you think about when I came into the room, how much information you managed to process in the space of that first second, you know, you
very
gauge what I you would gauge what I look like,
yeah,
what I was wearing, maybe even my mood, like how anxious I was or tense, and even where I was moving to and how you'd have to move to shake my hand, right? All of that in the space of a second.
Was so, remembering when you when I met you last, yeah.
Exactly. So all that information coming in floods, right? So you can imagine then, if we want to actually study how that happens in the brain, that we have to have measurements of brain activity that are really quick and that are able to measure brain activity when it happens. So as you mentioned, MRI, for example, is a really, it's the best method we have for non-invasively determining where in the brain or which parts of the brain are active, but it's quite sluggish in terms of the timing of activity. It's measuring activity over several seconds of time. So we're missing a lot of that detail.
Mm.
We also have measures like EEG, as you mentioned, that give us that readout millisecond by millisecond, actually, of when different brain areas are active. But it's very poor at telling us which parts of the brain are active during that time.
Because it's over the scalp.
Exactly, it's over the scalp. And to get into a bit more nitty-gritty detail, like what it's recording is electrical activity that our brain cells generate when they're active. But those signals get distorted as they pass through the skull and the scalp. And so then it gets very difficult to trace back where they came from when you're recording on the surface like
right.
that. Exactly.
And the only way to do that is to open up the scalp, which they actually exactly. do with some epilepsy do. Patients, right?
Exactly.
To have a really good idea of what's going on in the brain.
Exactly. If you want to have like really good knowledge, then you'd put it right onto the brain directly.
Cut a flap off the skull.
Exactly.
Not always
exactly.
convenient, of course.
Not at all, yeah. So what's exciting then about this new technology, this what's called OPM-MEG, which was developed, the system that we've just acquired thanks to a Research Ireland grant in Trinity, was developed by physicists in Nottingham. And it's a real breakthrough because it's giving us both the when and the where, right? That thing that we've been lacking, the two things together. So what it does is it measures the magnetic fields that our brain cells produce. So they produce electrical and magnetic fields. Those magnetic fields are not distorted in the same way as electrical fields are when they pass through the skull and scalp. So as a result, that technique is much better able to locate where the activity is coming from.
Right.
And then also those magnetic field changes are very rapid and can be very rapidly detected.
And these magnetic field changes that happen, are they... there is a result of the electricity, because electricity exactly. and magnetism are two sides of the same coin. Is that the idea?
Exactly.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Well, so when you have groups of neurons, like populations of neurons that are active at once together, they produce these very tiny magnetic fields.
Yeah.
So it's really amazing.
It's kind of cool when you think about it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like where we're talking right now and I'm creating yeah. a magnetic field in my brain.
Exactly, yeah. And the technology that they've developed, which I'm not responsible for now, for these sensors is really quite amazing. So just very briefly, it's using quantum technology. So they have these little rubidium gas cells, right, that are maybe the size of your thumb, that are inserted into this helmet. And what they do is they pass a little laser through the cell, and that magnetizes the vapor and makes it extremely sensitive to any external magnetic fields
right.
nearby. So sensitive it's actually able to pick up the tiny magnetic fields that our brain activity produces. But the other big part of this technology then is that in order for the sensors to detect that brain activity, because it is so small, you have to place it in this magnetically shielded room that's excluding all the other magnetic fields that are out there in the environment.
I was just thinking, your iPhone or anything at all.
Even the Earth's magnetic field.
Right,
okay. Enough to like blot out the brain activity because it's so tiny. So yeah, the technology behind the room itself is really quite amazing. And
you have one of these rooms, presumably.
Yeah, we have one of these rooms.
Because
yeah.
there'd be no point in having the you didn't bring in the helmet. Why not? Because I was imagining this sort of Woody Allen sort of contraption, a big dome with bits hanging out of it, but it's not with you.
No, I suppose I could have, but they are quite expensive. The helmets themselves are just 3D printed.
You didn't trust me with it.
I didn't trust myself. I came over on my bike and I didn't want to smash it. They are just 3D printed sort of plastic helmets. They're like a bike helmet, very much like a bike helmet. Very light, really, to put on your head. And they have little holes in them and the sensors go into those holes.
Nice.
And the sensors themselves, that's where the magic happens. They're, you know, very intricate, very delicate technology. I definitely couldn't have brought one of those in.
Yeah, yeah. Very cool. Yeah. And so what will allow you to understand when it comes to something like, you know, obviously all of this research, while it is cool to have a new piece of technology in a sort of magnetic proof room, what you're doing is trying to improve patient outcomes, right? So what does this device help you do that you couldn't do before in terms of patient outcome?
Yeah, so I mean, we are going to use it a lot to just study the basic workings of the brain as well, right? And the better we understand how the brain works, the healthy brain works, and the better we can also understand what happens when we face a neurological disorder or something like that. So the basic research is a huge part of what we'll be doing here.
Great.
There'll be research studying various aspects of cognition and perception, language and so on. And again, that ability to measure when and where together opens up a whole lot of new research angles. Also, the fact that this helmet is lightweight means that participants can actually freely move while they're being recorded from. So we can have them walking around the room. They could be interacting with another person. These are all things that are very difficult to do, certainly with MRI. So again, from that basic research point of view, it's really exciting. Mm. From a patient point of view, the kind of most clear-cut angle that we're excited about is in relation to epilepsy, where, again, the ability to measure when activity is happening is really crucial because epileptic activity is very rapid. And so clinicians and neurologists who are working with patients with epilepsy are obviously very interested to know where the problem is, where in the brain it's arising. It can be very difficult to identify, again, because we're relying on non-invasive methods, or sometimes they have to resort to placing electrodes directly on the brain itself. Mm. And so MEG has the potential to really help with all of that. Now, again, this is just for research at the moment. We're not at the point where this can be like applied in the clinic, but it's something we're setting up projects to try and make that happen over the coming years. That's not my area of expertise, epilepsy, but we have others who are working on it.
It's very reductionary to call it a toy, right? But a new piece of kit that is very exciting, because I've been to labs where they're like, look at this thing. And I'm like, it's just a box. Yeah. I actually broke something very expensive once. We were doing a TV show. And they said, just put that back in there or whatever. Put it in the wrong way. And there's just like this crunch. And we were filming, but you can see the moment at which the director of this program realizes, I have just cost them a lot of money and they can't really do anything because filming. And they were just trying to be nice about it, but I could see this is not good. Anyway, so don't invite me to your lab. The question is, with that one, you know, with that device that costs something like that, what sort of a ripple effect does it have on the opportunities that you have to collaborate with other universities or inspire, you know, researchers to go, you know what, I really want to work with this thing. Like, does it have that sort of an effect when you get it?
It does, yeah. Like, I think this will end up being a hub for research. It's a national facility. It's not just for Trinity researchers to use. It's available to anyone. And, you know, when we were writing the application for funding from Research Ireland, we had letters from over 50 academics and people from industry and clinicians from hospitals all writing personal letters of support because they were really keen to use it. And they were from people from all over the island of Ireland. And that's something that we're working on right now, is getting everyone together to collaborate. It's already sparked new collaborations for me. For example, I'm now involved in a project studying social interaction and theory of mind, which is an area that I've never really worked in myself. I generally studied decision making at a much more basic level. So it's broadening my horizons and also creating these other collaborations with clinical groups like the epilepsy project that I mentioned, that really are only made possible because we have this new tool.
Mm. And of course, you know, we say it all the time in the program, but the brain being the most complicated computer that exists in the universe, as far as we're aware, you know, anything that helps us understand how things work better is always a good thing. But as a professor in decision neuroscience, I presume you read the two Nature papers that were out this week looking at decision making in mice, the big consortium ones. What they were saying was that that when it came to decision making, they were surprised to see that 95% of the brain was involved in decision making. And one of the questions I wanted to ask was, doesn't that make it really difficult to figure out, you know, I mean, the hard problem of neuroscience is consciousness, understanding, you know, what makes us so different from animals as far as we can see, that's this sense of self. And, you know, we had this idea that there are discrete parts of the brain, that this does that and this does this. And if this study, you know, tells us anything, it's that all of our brain is being used in decision making. As you talked, when you walked in that door, is that a very depressing paper to read as a neuroscientist? Does it make you go,
yeah,
I don't oh think. God, wouldn't it be lovely if they'd found something much more acute or distinct than that you could then study?
I mean, we often have these reactions in our lab meetings where we're like, oh, for God's sake, the brain, it never plays ball. It always has to be more complicated than what we thought. Yeah, I find that stuff exciting though. Like those mysteries are kind of why we're in this game and what we're chasing after.
And that's why we're very different people.
Yeah, but that thing about the different brain areas, like all seeming to be involved in decision making, is a really interesting fact. It's been shown in other realms as well. But basically, if you give, say, an animal, because these are often animal studies where they're recording in directly
mice,
from the cells in the brain, and mice similar sorts of studies have been done in monkeys, where let's say they're trying to judge whether a cloud of dots are moving to the left or to the right, and they have to look in a particular direction to indicate left or look to indicate right, and they'll get a reward if they do it correctly. And you'll see, lots of, you know, basically all the areas that they record from are responding to all of these task features. So like all the areas are responding to whether the dots are moving left or right and whether the monkey is going to look left or right.
And you think that would be such a simple thing. Like it sounds like such a simple thing for the brain to do, look left or look right, but it's clearly not.
But there are like subtle distinctions in the way they respond.
Right.
So for example, often it's in the timing with which they respond, so they won't all necessarily respond at exactly the same time. So for example, the areas of the brain that are specialized for detecting motion will respond first, and then the areas that are actually translating that motion information into a decision to act will respond next. So you have to really have very creative and very like subtle experimental designs in order to prize these things apart. But I think what you're touching on though is that we still have these big unknowns about how the brain organizes itself, right? How it's able to, you know, delegate different tasks to different brain areas, or to what extent these roles that the brain performs arise more in an emergent way from like the concerted activity of lots of different brain areas, and that maybe you can't find it by just looking at one cell at a time, that it's in the collective that these processes emerge.
And
that's a big debate in neuroscience at the moment, is even like, what's the right way to go about studying this type of question?
It seems like we're at the end, but we're obviously very much at the beginning. You know, as someone who's made it his life to spend a large amount of his career in the room with smarter people, you know, hearing that my brain is doing so many different things, it gives me some sort of sense of relief that I'm not as stupid as I think I am sometimes. Brilliant to speak to you, Professor Redmond O'Connell, decision neuroscience professor at Trinity College Dublin. Thanks for your time, and enjoy your time with your new toy.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Right, time to look back at some of your comments from last week. We had Alwyn Morris on. She's an audiologist and owner of Medico Audiology. She was talking about misophonia, this horrific reaction that people have to sounds when people chewing or scratching or just usually mouth-related noises. I asked if you have ever experienced this. Loads of comments on this. I heard with delight your piece on misophonia or misophonia. Thank you so much for highlighting the condition. Your questions were excellent, especially the one on could it be other people's bad eating habits. We are hypersensitive to these people. I will make inquiries with professionals. However, my initial thought or reaction is it would be torturous to engage with CBT, as I understand you have to expose yourself to the irritant and learn to adjust your mindset. Climbing Everest would be easier to achieve. Thank goodness I don't suffer from anxiety or depression, just this one condition of misophonia. Otherwise, happy and healthy. Keep up the good work. CBT. It isn't the same as exposure therapy. There are different types of therapies, and CBD, I don't think, always includes exposure therapy. I think they're slightly different. Alex says, just listen to the program on misophonia. Our daughter suffered from the condition since she was about 7 or 8. She's 13 now, And she's managed to put coping measures in place so she can manage to attend school and have a normalish social life. But she hasn't sat at the dinner table with us for years, and it's a daily cause of major stress in family life. You were saying you'd love to sit with people like us to see if maybe she's right and we're just disgusting eaters. She had just been in the kitchen shouting at us to stop eating while she made herself lunch, and the wife was laughing and I was stuffing scrambled egg into my face with bits falling out. We have tried in the past to get help for Katie, but no one in Ireland seems to know anything about the condition. Love the show. Alex, maybe look, maybe physician, heal thyself first and see. But it sounds like this is not, in reality, not something to joke about. So look, it's good that you have a sense of humour about it, but I feel awful for your daughter. So sorry to hear about that, Katie. And I hope my voice is not one of those voices that triggers misophonia in you. Another one says, I was delighted to hear your piece on misophonia. Suffered from this for years, as well as hyperacusis, which is repetitive sounds and loud noises, like boy racers with loud exhausts, Harley Davidsons, and every shop and pub has loud music playing these days. It's impossible to hear or be heard. I can't go to these places. The noise drives me crazy. I'm very sensitive to noise. I think as someone who works in radio, I have tinnitus, and I'm very sensitive to different noises. People who talk nonstop, guilty as charged, I'm afraid. And children screaming is another trigger. It caused a lot of problem at home when the kids were young. No one could understand why I was so ratty and contrary. Loud people or phones going off on train or buses or people looking at stuff on phones without using headphones. Well, that's everybody. Everyone gets annoyed by that. This society is all noise these days. There's no escape for people like me, and I'm glad to hear I'm not unique. Silence is such a rare commodity in the modern world, and people who sit you in a table beside a drinks fridge that goes and don't think about it, they deserve to be shot. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Gavin, and Hugo de Silva on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proofing your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy this silence and stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.